Hey, good evening, everybody. Thank you for joining us to this panel of the experts. This is a great opportunity of having top leaders in multiple areas in reproduction, pregnancy, and environment, and infections as well, to answer the questions of the public and your interest in this. And this one is one of the most important periods in the life of an individual, that is the pregnancy. So first of all, I want to thank all the experts for participating in this panel. And what I would like is to ask each of you to introduce yourself and tell in a couple of words, a couple of sentences, what is your main areas of interest. Okay, so I'll start myself, and then maybe we go around the table. Okay. My name is Gil Moore. I am an MD-PhD, and I am the director of the CSMOT Center. My areas of interest is reproductive immunology.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Johnson. I'm a CSMOT Endowed Professor of Public Health at Michigan State University in Flint. I'm a clinical psychologist. I work with maternal mental health and substance use and maternal health equity.
So my name is Jackie Sobel, and I'm a professor of medicine at Wayne State University School of Medicine. And my area of interest is infectious diseases, in particular infections of the lower genital tract in women.
Hi, my name is Kam Chen. I'm associate professor of OBGYN at Wayne State. I studied mother's immune system and allergies and infants.
I'm Kevin Tice. I'm an associate professor at Wayne State in School of Medicine, and my specialty is microbiomes of the reproductive tract and the role of microbes in pregnancy complications.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jeffrey Dean. So I'm an assistant professor in the Wayne State University. My study is focusing on the viral infection during pregnancy to see how they impact the fetal immune system development.
Hello, my name is Marta Rodriguez Garcia. I'm an associate professor at Wayne State University, and I study how women acquire HIV through sexual transmission.
Hi, everyone. My name is Ahize Eke. I'm also MD-PhD, associate professor of OBGYN, maternal fetal medicine and clinical pharmacology at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, Maryland. My expertise is in PKPD, pharmacoepi, as pharmacogenomics of drugs used during pregnancy, with specific focus on preterm birth and HIV.
This is Jay Ramados. I'm a professor at OBGYN and the director of the Pregnancy and Environment Group here at the Wayne State University. And we do research in maternal fetal biology and gestational exposures.
Thank you. My name is Alex Usla. I am an MD, a PhD, and a third year. I'm a fellow here at Wayne State University. My interests are in biomarkers of preterm labor and preeclampsia, as well as prediction and prevention of preterm labor.
Thank you. And we have one expert in the Zoom, Dr. Gunning.
Hi, I was just trying to sign into my Amazon account to start my Christmas shopping, and I must have gotten the wrong address in here. Good evening, everyone. My name is Bernie Gonick. I'm an obstetrician gynecologist with specialty training in maternal fetal medicine. I've had a long-standing interest in infectious diseases as it relates to the pregnant patient, and I've been involved in helping to develop the maternal vaccine platform for the last 20 years or so.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Again, we will start the conversation here, but we will try to open to the public once we start receiving some questions. To the public, again, feel free either to unmute yourself, or you can write your questions on the chat. And we have an expert in chat reading, that is George. He will be looking at your questions, and we will bring to the experts. So let me start a little. Put it on the table, a question to everybody here at the table, and maybe Ake or any of you. In your opinion, what are the major problems or complications in pregnancy? Ake.
Thank you, Dr. Gilmore, for that question. So for me, I think the two big ones that stand out to me are preterm birth and preeclampsia. These are like the disease states, but obviously there are other conditions that we see in pregnancy, including other socioeconomic issues. But in terms of disease states, I think it's preterm birth and preeclampsia.
So preterm birth and preeclampsia, maybe we'll start developing a little more about those two subjects. Dr. Gonick, do you share any other different interests in your area that you think is another important complication during the pregnancy?
Well, not so much a complication, but as I mentioned just a minute ago, it's a very exciting time for us right now in that the maternal vaccine platform is expanding, and we now, for the first time, have a commercially available vaccine to give to the mother so that she can develop antibodies to pass over to her baby to protect her against respiratory syncytial virus, a very, very serious newborn and early infant respiratory infection. So this has just happened within the last few weeks. And it's very exciting because, again, we've now broken the barrier in terms of being able to research with pregnant individuals to assist them in improving their care and their baby's care. And again, this is just one of many avenues that will be opening up shortly.
That is correct. And I think we will try to dedicate a little time to that question, vaccination during pregnancy. But I think somebody else have another subject, because I was going to go to you, Jennifer. Maternal mortality is a major problem in the United States compared to other countries. Can you talk a little about maternal mortality?
Yes, but I want to add two things to your previous question. Mental health and partner violence, for me, are big, important things during pregnancy. Yeah, so unfortunately, in the U.S., we have the highest maternal mortality rate in high-income countries. Ours is going up while others are going down. And we have big disparities with African-American women and Native American women having 3 to 4 times the rates of non-Hispanic white women.
That's a serious problem.
Yes.
What are we doing to solve that problem?
You know, there is a lot that's going on. But I'll say, you know, some of the most accessible things, I think, for people out there, if you Google CDC Hear Her, it's a website that has warning signs, both for pregnant people, postpartum people, their family members, their doctors, so that, you know, if you see one of these warning signs, you know you need to go talk to somebody.
Yeah.
Because most people die during pregnancy or in the year postpartum, not necessarily in the hospital.
Interesting. But I think any other causes of maternal mortality that you would like to bring?
So maternal mortality, basically, we divide the causes as direct and indirect. Direct means that the cause happened as a result of a pregnancy complication that has a direct cause of pregnancy, like, you know, preeclampsia, like bleeding from pregnancy, and all that. While indirect is something that happens that is not directly related to pregnancy. For example, gunshot wounds, you know, within the 6 from when they are pregnant to up to 6 weeks postpartum. Suicide is definitely something that is on the increase right now in the US, and it's something that has brought attention to us as well as with GYNs. And so it's an area that we have to explore.
It's something to explore in that aspect. There is all the environmental factors that are affecting also the pregnancy. And maybe I go to you, Dr. Ramados. We know alcohol, we know tobacco. Still, we are in a major problem increasing the use of other type of drugs. Could you tell us a little bit, in your opinion, what is the impact of all these things into the pregnancy of the child?
So I think it sort of affects the family as a unit, every member of the family. And there is, in most of these kind of research, there is a great stigma associated with approaching and asking. So which sort of like takes us back in terms of how much progress we can do, but maybe you can add further into what I've said.
And everybody, please, if you feel free to add any comment or anything before we open the questions to the public.
I guess I would just say in terms of substance use. So, you know, like we said before, there are direct medical causes of death, and there's things like substance use, you know, overdose, homicide, suicide. Those are actually most, well, more than half of the deaths during pregnancy and postpartum. And I guess, you know, as a psychologist, it's the moms who are the most addicted who usually can't stop using during pregnancy, but there's so much shame around it. Mm. And I wish as a, you know, system that we, instead of, you know, judging and punishing the moms, did more just to get them into care.
Yeah. And how to help them.
Yeah.
And how to help them. Okay. So I think we have now a good number of questions from the public. So maybe we'll start going to them in the first one. Well, there was one. Why do you think our mortality rate is going up? Who wants to take that question? Dr. Gonick.
Yeah, sure. Let me take a stab at least, you know, some of the thoughts on it. One of the reasons that's commonly given is that given our ability to get even patients who typically weren't pregnant in the past now pregnant with chronic diseases, infertility, and so on, we've actually got a different population of obstetric patients. And these patients are inherently at higher risk for a variety of complications, including mortality. So our renal failure patients, our severe diabetics, our chronic hypertensive patients are now finding their way to getting pregnant. And because of that, I think we're seeing some of the repercussions related to the complications or adverse events related to pregnancy. The problem is that that's not a total answer. And although it may be a partial reason for why that's true, I think there's a much more important and perhaps deeper maybe, and I see heads waving, deeper reason. And that is, and I'm taking this from, I spent a year at USAID and being in Africa.
Looking USAID, at I have no idea what does it mean.
So it's a government agency that's a part of the State Department. I spent a year on sabbatical there as a fellow. And one of the things
you're giving me two difficult worlds, Dr. Gonick, and sabbatical, USD. Tell me, what is it? Would you mind to explain to us what is the USD?
Sure. Sure. So I took a year off of work and went to work for the State Department in Washington, D.C. And one of their agencies, USAID, is a specific agency that gives support to folks outside of the United States. And that includes a significant chunk of support for health-related concerns. And I was involved in their maternal fetal medicine division at USAID. And so I had the opportunity to spend a fair amount of time in a variety of different African countries. The reason I bring that up is it's remarkable how similar the problems are in Africa and in underdeveloped countries and in urban communities within our own United States. And so in terms of access to care, trust of the healthcare system,
so that would be an answer.
Equity in care and even things like food deserts. It's amazing. You could be sitting in the middle of Detroit or Baltimore or New Jersey, and you could actually be living in a food desert, which means within a relatively short distance from your home, you can't access healthy food for pregnancy. So to me, one of the remarkable things that's going on, at least in this country, is we're beginning to realize that despite our level of development, in terms of the actual care we give to patients within those vulnerable communities, those underserved communities, we have a lot of work ahead of us.
So that relates, and maybe we often hear from others, that is one of in the Zoom asking, compared to other developed countries, the U.S. has the highest maternal mortality. And I think this is the main question. What are we doing wrong? Gentlemen and ladies, what are we doing wrong?
And so I don't know that anybody knows for sure, but my guess relates to what the other speaker just said, is that, you know, everybody else, high-income countries are going down and we're going up. And for me, I think, and, you know, all those countries have access to getting sicker and older people pregnant, so I can't be that. That's not our reason. I think it has to do with the inequities of what you just said of, you know, people not trusting the system, not having access to the system, not having access to basic things they need. I mean, there's health disparities in the cities, but there's health disparities. Rural patients are just as bad. You know, there's counties with no psychiatrist in them.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, that's what I would guess.
There is an area. Go ahead, please.
There are two other things that I would like to add to that. So
One is that we are actually increasing how we kind of detect some of these conditions that cause mothers to die during pregnancy. As we know in the US, the commonest reason why women die during pregnancy is cardiac causes. And we're beginning to do more of these imaging tests to figure out these things. And it's a reason. The second thing that I would like to add is that in Maryland, the commonest cause of maternal death is actually opioid use and abuse.
That's what it
is. And so that is, US has the highest rate in all the, you know, all the developed countries. And so that is also contributing to why we're seeing higher rates of maternal death in the US compared to other countries.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But there is an aspect too. We just hear also that sexual transmitted diseases and infections are growing in the United States. It's going up. And it's going to up also in pregnant women. Dr. Sobel, you have a lot of experience in this area. Could you give us a little light? What are we dealing with sexual transmitted diseases and potentially pregnancy?
So all the common sexually transmitted infections we see in men and women, which in, and particularly striking has been the return of syphilis, both in men and women, and particularly women in pregnancy, and as a consequence of that, congenital or infants born with who are infected during the pregnancy in utero. So, but it's not only syphilis; it's gonorrhea, it's chlamydia, and all the STIs or sexually transmitted infections have increased. It would appear that one might have hoped that with COVID and the constant appearance in the press that we need to improve the public health service. We have an inadequate public health service in the wealthiest country worldwide, in the United States, and yet the public health service and access to care to all strata of society is anything but to be proud of. And one thought the message, when we paid such a price for a poor access to healthcare system and in problems in the nursing homes and the access of the elderly to quality healthcare and inadequate support of that very at-risk, vulnerable strata of society, that we learned something during COVID.
Yeah.
And we did not.
We
have not yet. The politicians did not learn the lesson. And they are still driven by other considerations, and their public health does not remain a priority. It's not surprising, therefore, that maternal mortality has increased in many aspects, all the parameters by which we judge a healthcare system, like, you know, longevity, age of demise, how long are people going to live, etc. All these parameters are deteriorating in the United States. We're not investing in a
so technology and science goes up, care is going down.
And we've just seen, I'll finish in a second.
Yeah.
No, we've just seen over the last few months that there's been a decline in the availability of Medicaid, which increasingly became available through Obamacare. And working with the population of Detroit, we saw an extraordinary improvement in the availability of healthcare and access to pharmaceutical, to drugs, medications,
yeah.
The right drugs.
Yeah.
During, as a result of the Obamacare, and for the first time as a practitioner dealing with this population, we didn't struggle with every second patient as to whether they either were uninsured and couldn't afford medication.
Mm.
That improved dramatically, and now it was extended through,
and now it's going
to the epidemic, through the
it's
pandemic,
ended.
And now it's ended, and people have lost their insurance, and we just are going around in circles.
Or less, we're going back to what Dr. Goni was saying. We have another question. Let's see. Let's start reading a little. What is the? Oh, okay. So we move to preterm birth, and there is a question here open to everybody. Does preterm birth affect a child's chances for autism?
So I'm going to say that autism is something that we have to be careful how we associate with conditions, just because we are still trying to figure out what causes autism, right? Now, we know that there's a difference between causation and association. I can tell you for sure that.
Can you clarify a little what is causation, association? You got me lost already.
Okay. So causation means something you are sure when you do something, it results in this other thing. So if we say preterm birth causes autism, that means that anyone who has preterm birth would eventually get autism. But when we say associations, what it means is that it is possible that when you have preterm birth, we might also see autism within that spectrum of people who have
preterm. So in other words, there is any evidence that preterm birth will increase the risk of having a child with autism?
Yeah, so we don't have that evidence. What we know is that there is the association between preterm birth and autism. But we cannot say that preterm birth causes autism. And the reason is because babies are born preterm.
You know, as a mother or as a father, if my child is a preterm birth, immediately I think, you know, my goodness, is my child at risk of having autism? He might come to you and say, is my child, there is any possibility that my child is going to develop autism? Why would you tell me?
I will tell you that we don't know. The reason being that a preterm child has other conditions that can affect that baby's health.
Okay.
And affect baby's, you know, brain as well, like intraventricular hemorrhage. They could bleed, you know, into their brain. They could have abnormal malformation of their organs. And so those things by themselves can present with things that looks like autism.
So it's not the same, it's not just the preterm birth.
Exactly.
It's all the things associated
right.
with the mother having a baby to it.
That's preterm, exactly.
Very good. You wanted to say something as a young MFM?
Oh, no. Actually, Dr. Sobol brought it up at the very end. I was going to comment on the in the chat about the developed countries versus the United States, and that having worked in FQHC myself, a federally qualified health center, which is one where a lot of patients or the patients either have no insurance or they have Medicare, Medicaid, majority. I was going to bring up that the key thing with America is that we don't have versus other developed countries don't have universal health care until the Affordable Care Act was initiated. So
it's a major challenge that we have. And again, it goes that in spite of having so much technology, we are understanding so many diseases, the implementation of all what we discover is not done, not properly to everybody.
Yeah, not all the sickest people. And the sickest people are the ones that are most likely to have problems accessing.
And they are not benefiting for all what we are doing in the lab and the research and so on. Let's move to another long question. What are your opinions on the ever-changing food, health, and medical recommendations for pregnant women? I think it's also for bacteria and so on that we're going to get. For example, seafood is not recommended for pregnant women here in the U.S., but in countries where seafood is the main source of food, pregnant women eat and they don't have any problem usually. Should these recommendations vary from person to person versus being a general recommendation? Dr. Ghani, would you like to say something about that? And we'll talk maybe something about bacteria from there.
So I'm sort of a big believer in everything in moderation. But when you talk about, for example, seafood, seafood is...
Caution, by the way, Dr. Gunning.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
So in the United States, seafood is not contraindicated in pregnancy, but it's supposed to be eaten in moderation. The reason for seafood has to do with the mercury that may or may not be contained in that product, and we don't consume typically heavy metals or a great deal of heavy metals in pregnancy because theoretically and in some examples for real can cross the placenta and affect the baby in an adverse way. So that's the argument for why seafood typically isn't used. But again, some seafood is more safe than others. If you think about this, it's always a balance. So in countries where your only available protein is a seafood product, and if in fact it's not heavily contaminated, then it's a perfectly good product to use for protein consumption in pregnancy. So I think we have to be careful to take, you know, global suggestions and try to apply them without at least thinking them through and understanding the rationale for why they were put in place in the first place.
Very good. And I think that's what Emily and this Zoom was asking. So definitely it's not a general recommendation, but we have to be careful where it gets, when we get that food from. And again, talking a little about environment, there is always a question now, and there is a lot of people talking about this transplant of bacteria to solve the problems of infertility, or even preterm birth, if you do transplant, bacterial transplant will benefit. Could you tell us a little, what is the role of bacteria in our body, especially in pregnant reproduction?
Well, in terms of reproduction, ideally it wouldn't play that big a role because there shouldn't be bacteria and microorganisms in the amniotic cavity where the baby is developing. When issues arise, it's largely due to microorganisms entering that cavity. There's not too much that you can do to prevent that we can say is causal. It's largely unknown at this point. And in terms of anything to do with transplants or probiotics or prebiotics of giving specific microorganisms to the body or specific foods for the microbes to the body, all research in that area is still ongoing, in process, and premature. So I wouldn't...
We still are in the way to learn many things.
Much more to learn.
Yeah.
The only place where you have those sorts of transplants is in a person who has chronic Clostridium difficile infection.
So there is a general idea. I mean, the bacteria is also communicating with the body and can create a status of a systemic inflammation or an inflamed person that may have effect either the fertility or in general the pregnancy. But you say it still is something that we need to further understand.
Definitely further understand. Even if there is, for example, an endometrial microbiome that's influencing the likelihood of fertilization, even there, we're still, is there really even a microbiome there, let alone does the structure of it influence the likelihood of fertilization?
Interesting. The subject to discuss a lot. What is your opinion, Dr. Sol?
Now, in my clinical practice, it's become remarkable how many women I see, pregnant, non-pregnant, who are taking probiotics. The probiotics that are available are not drugs. These are live microorganisms, which can be taken by mouth, and sometimes they can be taken per vagina or by any route. And probiotics are commercially available because they're not drugs. They are not monitored by the FDA.
Yeah.
So
that means you can take it from anywhere.
So there's no standardization and quality control about probiotics. Now, it's certainly standard of care and good standard of care for all pregnant women as they see their obstetrician gynecologist who is ever responsible for them during their pregnancy. They're going to be given routine probiotic care, vitamins as part of that is required during a normal healthy pregnancy. But far in excess of that, and very often driven by, not by practitioners, but by patients themselves and what they read in social media, they now have access to probiotics. And the first principle about probiotics is that probiotics are not necessarily safe. The second principle is they are expensive. And three, they rarely are useful or indicated. And it's a tremendous opportunity to throw away money.
I think we're going to organize one talking to the expert only about probiotics. Can you spend an hour with that? I have eclampsia with my first baby. Should I worry about that for my future pregnancies?
Preeclampsia.
I didn't see the pre.
Yeah.
Preeclampsia, thank you.
Brittany, so yes.
Could you just define us a little, what is preeclampsia?
Okay. Preeclampsia, simply defined, is high blood pressure that has end organ damage. So for example, high blood pressure with evidence of some kind of end organ affectation, like if it affects your cardiovascular system, you could have headaches, blurry vision, affects the kidneys, it could lead to proteinuria, that is leaking protein from the urine, or the kidneys could cause your creatinine levels to go up, and it could affect any organ system. So we know that once a woman has preeclampsia during pregnancy, the risk in subsequent pregnancies goes up And that risk could be anywhere between 9 to 15% with the next pregnancy and could go as high as 20% in subsequent pregnancies. The good news is that we have ways to try to prevent this. We can, we usually would, when you get pregnant the next time, early in pregnancy, we do a screening where we bring you in, get a history from you, and then try to use ultrasound, looking at uterine blood flow through your uterine arteries, and in that way classify your risk for preeclampsia. And then we offer aspirin, which we start anywhere between 12 to 16 weeks of pregnancy to try to reduce that risk. Aspirin reduces the risk by about 10 to 20%. So with aspirin, that risk goes down a little bit. It does not go away completely, but aspirin helps to reduce that risk. And then we also advise exercise as well.
Okay, fantastic.
This and this are connected.
Okay, there is a very interesting and I think important question for two people. Does antibiotic use during pregnancy increase the chance that the child develop asthma? And the other one is, are the exposure that may increase chances? Oh yeah, it's, both of them are interesting. And that goes also with bacteria. The use of antibiotics during pregnancy increase the possibility, increase the risk of the child to have asthma.
So I think, you know, we can hear from Dr. Gonick as a maternal-fetal medicine specialist as well as an ID doctor, but I, as an infectious disease doctor, taking antibiotics in pregnancy, is there's no reason, if there's a good, sound indication to take the antibiotics, the there's no evidence that antibiotics are going to increase the risk of asthma in the
newborn, the child,
newborn, yeah. As an infant or child, there's no reason. Let's hear from Dr. Connick to see if he agrees. And antibiotic use should be, prescribing an antibiotic should always be a thoughtful process. It should never be a flippant, trivial decision, regardless. And,
so if there is a need for that.
If there's a need, it should be prescribed.
Not for prevention.
There, and doctors usually have additional knowledge as to which antibiotics should not be given in pregnancy, such as tetracycline, et cetera, which could just cause deep discoloration and so forth.
Yeah.
But otherwise, if indicated, if needed, they should be prescribed and taken.
Dr. Gonick, do you would like to add anything to this?
First, that I don't think I have ever in my life disagreed with Dr. Sobel. Jackie, I'm you're 100% right. First, I don't know of any direct correlation between the use of antibiotics in pregnancy and the effects on the fetus or newborn related to wheezing or asthma. Secondly, unfortunately, in this country, the general trend is we're all poor antibiotic stewards, and we use way too many antibiotics. And I think you'll agree with me on that, Jack. But if there's a clear indication, there are safe antibiotics to be used in pregnancy, and we don't worry about issues related to wheezing or asthma. I will take the advantage of the moment to tell people that there is a concern related to wheezing and asthma, and that's related to RSV infection. And Jack, you can help me here as well, that there seems to be relatively good data to suggest that children who develop RSV have, as a risk factor long-term, risks related to asthma and wheezing. And it's another good argument for why we want to use protection through the mother's passive transfer of antibody to the baby, antibody to the baby, to reduce the risk of RSV infection in those young vulnerable children.
So maybe before we go to answer the other question, there is more questions. There's one.
Well, are there any exposures that may increase the chances of asthma?
And I think that has been answered with us.
Okay.
Because maybe we bring what Dr. Gonick just said, the vaccination. And maybe we ask Dr. Chen, we know that the mother educates the immune system of the fetus by giving antibodies. Could you tell us a little about the transfer of antibodies during pregnancy?
So we know that during pregnancy, the mother transfers a lot of things to the fetus, both nutrients, small molecules, and lymph nodes also remove small effects from the fetus, metabolic wastes, for example. But when the body is one of the things the mother transfers to the fetus, we think that this is a protective way, a way of mothers protect the fetus from infections shortly after birth that the baby is going to be exposed to.
So that would be one of the benefits of vaccination.
Correct.
During pregnancy, given the protection.
We have several vaccines that the FDA and ACH recommends that every pregnant woman gets for every pregnancy. For example, TDAP, tetanus, cellular pertussis vaccine, diphtheria, cellular pertussis vaccine, the influenza vaccine, our mom's vaccines are recommended for every pregnant woman in every pregnancy.
Yeah.
The COVID, the two COVID vaccines, mRNA vaccines, have been shown to be safe and in pregnant populations during the pandemic. Yeah.
And then, go ahead, please.
Okay. Well, no, I was just going to say, the most recent, the RSV vaccine has been found safe in pregnancy.
RSV, what is RSV?
A respiratory syncytial virus.
And what does it do?
It's a fancy name. It's an infection that the children can get. It's a seasonal infection that affects their airway and can be potentially very devastating for those who are unvaccinated, which is why it's not recommended that all pregnant women receive this vaccine. Now, the vaccine takes a little bit of time for the mother to create what are called the antibodies that you mentioned, and then there are only certain type of the antibodies that can cross the placenta. And so it's important to get this vaccine as well as the Tdap vaccine that you mentioned at the end of pregnancy, so that way the certain type that can protect the baby transfers and is still there when the baby is born. Because if it's given too early, they won't be in the baby's system to help protect it.
So the gist is, if you're pregnant, get vaccinated. It protects your baby. It doesn't hurt your baby. It helps the baby.
That's correct. The vaccination that we saw, there has been a major fight in this aspect because misconceptions have put pregnant women outside of vaccination trials. But I hope these misconceptions are disappearing, because vaccine protects two individuals, the mother and the baby. So vaccination, I think, is extremely important.
Hey, Gil?
Yep.
Yeah, I love the topic, but can we go back just for a second? There was a question about asthma, and are there things that can cause asthma related to pregnancy? And Jay, you're sitting right there. We're breaking new ground on environmental toxins and the effect of the environmental toxins long-term on the fetus and newborn and that child afterwards. And we know from our, I think you'll agree, from our pediatric pulmonary subspecialty folks, that this is a significant issue, in particular in large urban areas where there tends to be environmental toxins in the air and so on. Gil or Jay, this is your area. Can you take us on a little bit of tour of where you're going with this?
So in terms of exposures, we see that all the time in with reference to a greater proclivity for a certain kind of infectious agent. For instance, let's say in fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, there is a specific association with the strep B. So there is a greater chance that children who are diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders have a greater chance for having.
When you talk about the fetal alcohol syndrome, what do you mean?
So when fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, a person who's pregnant has had alcohol exposure during pregnancy.
So if a pregnant woman has one glass of wine, then the child will have a problem, the alcohol syndrome. What is the amount of alcohol that will have an impact on the child?
Okay, so there is no safe amount of alcohol which is recommended during pregnancy.
Oh, so that's interesting. So your recommendation is a pregnant woman should not drink alcohol.
That is any person who's pregnant to abstain from, or those who are trying to become pregnant to abstain from alcohol is the recommendation of the United States Surgeon General.
Yeah.
And one of the things which is really understudied in this field of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders is that of pulmonary infections. The field is heavily focused with respect to learning, memory, and different neurodevelopmental deficits, which have there is a why a large amount of data available in that area. But the area is really nascent with respect to pulmonary infections, which is one of the highest causes of mortality in the neonatal setting.
And I think it's still that, although it is recommended not to drink alcohol,
mm-hmm.
drinking alcohol during pregnancy is still is a major problem.
That is right.
What about smoking?
Tobacco smoking is usually we see that it goes somewhat concomitant. There is use of alcohol, smoking, and perhaps even other substances, some of which was even mentioned by the other panel members here. And alcohol, it may cause a span of deficits in the developing baby, which could be with respect to growth restrictions, certain classic craniofacial features, and also affect a wide variety of organs. But the key feature here is it affects different babies differently, that it makes the diagnosis, mm-hmm. treatment, and understanding of the etiology.
What would be your recommendation in general?
I would just repeat the recommendation of the Surgeon General of the United States that if any pregnant person who to abstain from drinking or and those who are wanting
what about
to
the smoking also? Because the smoking decreases the risk of preeclampsia, yeah?
Well, can I add something to that?
Please.
When I was living in Rhode Island when marijuana became legal and I worked in I was working with pregnant moms and there was sort of this conversation of it's legal, we must be able to do it in pregnancy. So marijuana is legal, it is also not good for you in pregnancy. So don't drink, don't smoke tobacco, don't smoke marijuana.
That's a recommendation. Everybody agrees?
Agreed.
Okay, that's the message. Yes.
What about, like, we live in an area where there's a lot of manufacturing and industry, and you pass by all these factories, and you see all the plumes that's going up into the sky. What about, like...
So that's the question. How the environment affects the mother and affects the fetus potentially? Maybe Dr. Dink, you can tell us a little. No, that's part of your work.
Sure. So the air pollution nowadays, they impact everybody, including especially the pregnant woman, because they need to breathe more air and they have more burden from the fetus. So in this way, they are more exposed to the pollution air. So the maternal immune system can be activated by virus or the non-infectious environmental stressor, such as the air pollution. So the maternal immune system responds to these stimuli, which can cause the local inflammation in the placenta. Although there's no direct impact on the fetus, the inflammation happening in the placenta can trigger the inflammation, and this cytokine, chemokines, this small molecule can pass through the placenta to the fetus, which can lead a long-term consequence in the offspring.
Thank you. So I think I'm understanding the idea that during pregnancy, in areas of high pollution are not good, unfortunately.
Air filter, if you can't move, air filters.
That's correct. I mean, it's just true that we're going to the message, every pregnant woman move to another areas, but I think there are ways how to take care of that, like air filters.
But don't move to New Delhi.
Or to Beijing. what developments, if any, are taking place regarding our understanding of placenta abruption?
So, in my understanding, it's very little. We still know that the risk factors we've known for a number of years are still risk factors for placental abruption. And those are preeclampsia or high blood pressure remains the commonest.
Why don't we talk a little about what is placental abruption first?
So
maybe the person who's asking had a personal experience, but I see the majority may not.
Right. So placental abruption is a situation whereby the placenta detaches from the uterus before the baby is born. Because naturally you want the placenta to detach after the baby comes out. An abruption occurs when the placenta is detached from the baby before it is born. And there are several reasons for that. The commonest we see is high blood pressure, which could either be from uncontrolled hypertension when it's chronic or from preeclampsia. It could also occur in the setting of use of drugs like cocaine, methamphetamine. Those are drugs that can cause, you know, an abruption. We see it with trauma, with road traffic accidents or things like that. So anything that increases the pressure within the uterine cavity can cause abruption. So in my knowledge, there's little that we've seen regarding our understanding of placental abruption.
And you know, when I have all these meetings, one of my I got sometimes depressed because we're talking about the most important period in evolution, that is pregnancy. And we have so many questions and no answers.
Exactly.
And there is so little money dedicated to research in women's health and pregnancy compared to other things. That is really a challenge.
Right.
Thank you. What are current treatments? What are current treatments for gestational diabetes? How does it affect my baby? You want to take that?
Sure. So gestational diabetes, by definition, is a diabetes that occurs during the pregnancy. The first thing we usually do is we routinely screen all women for gestational diabetes during the mid trimester or second trimester. Now, first thing you need to do is make sure you didn't have undiagnosed diabetes previously. Once that's ruled out, it depends on the levels of the sugars. First thing we do is start out with diet and exercise to try and control it. There's been extensive literature that shows that controlling diabetes, even gestational diabetes during pregnancy, benefits both mom and baby.
May I ask you a question? I'm pregnant, which may be possible. Today, everything is possible. I test my blood and have 170. I'm diagnosed already with...
So for a random blood test of 170, would not meet the criteria. Usually,
so what would you recommend? So because in many cases I have seen, one test, they come with 170 and already they're panicking.
Yeah.
What would your response to that? If you would get one result of 170?
So it would all depend on the circumstances about surrounding when you tested yourself. Now, where did you just eat a meal previously? Had you not eaten it in the last...
I went in the morning, I think my doctor told me, and I had 170. Do I have the diabetes, gestational diabetes?
Well, to clarify, you just took the fasting, or you took it after drinking the...
Now you're asking me too many questions.
So yes, if you had a fasting level that is 170, that would be diagnostic of diabetes.
Without taking the sugar?
Yeah, without taking
it. But you would recommend also a second test, not do the diagnostic with only one test.
Yeah.
Okay. What is the next one? How does it affect my baby? Sorry. How did the gestational diabetes affect the baby?
So the problem with gestational diabetes is if your sugar is very high, that sugar is in your bloodstream and it passes through the placenta to the baby. So the baby's seeing a very high level of sugar. And unlike you, if you have a high level of sugar, you can go for a walk, you can go run, you can get away, you can burn off that sugar. The way I'd like to think about it is the baby's trapped inside in this milieu, in this setting of very high sugar, and it's continuously consuming it. So the babies can actually get very big. If you think of the traditional statue of the Buddha sitting there, then they get the extra rolls, the babies can get that. So they can get very large. They can have problems with delivery. Their shoulders can get very enlarged. The fat pads have problems with that. And even if it's very, very uncontrolled to the point of babies even dying inside the womb. And so it's very important that we control it. And if we can't control it, or depending on the circumstances, sometimes it's actually safer to deliver a little prematurely, which means prior to 39 weeks. So 37, 38, sometimes beforehand, because it's a risk benefit that the baby being in the environment might be more dangerous than being born and outside of that environment.
So in summary, we understand this, it's very important to control that diabetes within pregnancy.
Very important.
Don't let it go. And exactly. The diet will be important also. You can manage with diet.
Diet and exercise, I recommend for all my patients, unless you have certain conditions in which you can't, it's not recommended to exercise. Yes.
Exercise and diet. No McDonald's, no the good things.
If possible. But again, we talked about the food deserts, and it depends on what, if you have
got
other options in your neighborhood.
Vegetables.
Yeah.
Is vacuum suction is still considered safe for delivery?
Yeah, so the answer is, the simple answer is yes. But I must caution that, you know, there are certain things we do to make sure that it's indicated. So first of all, there must be an indication, right? So, you know, perhaps you've pushed for a long time and the kid is not coming out and the head is right there, then we use it. So if there's an indication and there are no contraindications, for example, if this baby is preterm, we typically do not use a vacuum. The person who is doing it must be skilled in using the vacuum. And please, it has to be done in a hospital setting where we have facilities to go for a caesarean section if it fails. But overall, we still use them, they are safe once they are done appropriately and correctly.
Fantastic, thank you. So there is this question now going back, I think, to Detroit and Michigan. What more do we need to do for high-risk pregnancies in the U.S. and in Michigan? We have many state-of-the-art hospitals in Southeast Michigan and Detroit. How are we doing with health access to everyone? Doctors, and go ahead, yeah.
I'll say that Michigan and several other states just passed a law allowing Medicaid for 12 whole months postpartum. That's great.
Fantastic.
That's a win.
Yeah.
So support Medicaid for 12 months postpartum, but we have it now.
Beautiful. Any other aspects? Dr. Garnick, what do you think about the question, Michigan, Detroit, do we really have a state-of-the-art hospitals?
Well, I think the hospitals in general in the state and around the country are good. They're high level. They have high technology. I think, again, we said before, one of the major issues is getting pregnant patients into those environments and making them feel comfortable within those environments. And that's really the mountain that we have to climb. I think if you were going to try to answer this question easily, the one thing we can do, everyone can do, whether you're a physician or not, is to be a patient advocate. And my argument would be that if there was one thing, again, generally speaking, is recognize that we have issues here, like high mortality rates, higher preterm birth rates than we should have, and so on. And that's only going to be dealt with appropriately if we all take on the responsibility of being advocates for our pregnant patients. And so I guess that would be my sort of summary line as to what the entire community can do. And when I mean advocate, I mean remind patients that you feel comfortable talking to that they have to get early prenatal care, that they have to do the right thing in terms of diet and exercise and those sorts of things. We have to talk to our legislative body and remind them of the funding that's desperately needed to continue the work that we're doing right now in terms of research, in terms of access to care, and so on. So again, being a patient advocate, that's number one on my list.
Fantastic. And we will come at the end, what would be the message of each one? There is an important question because, unfortunately, Dr. Sobol will correct me, and we will ask Dr. Marta Rodriguez. HIV is a problem here in Detroit. There is a lot of patients with HIV. Marta, would you tell us a little bit? I mean, Sarah is asking, oh, go up, please. What risk are involved with pregnancy if you are exposed to HIV?
So I think this question depends on the timing of the exposure. And I can interpret different scenarios with this question. So one possibility is this person is worried about being pregnant and maybe be exposed to HIV. So in that case, there is something called pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is treatment you can take before you're exposed to HIV to avoid being infected. And there are drugs that are safe for pregnant women that can be used.
That is important to know. So there are drugs and there are treatments for prevention of infection of HIV if the person has a partner, let's say, who is HIV positive.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
And those are not teratogenic. They will not have an effect on the development of the fetus.
They've proven to be safe.
Fantastic. Those are great news.
There's another option where this person was already exposed. If the exposure was in a short period of time. There's,
I mean, in this, she's already positive.
She's already
infected with HIV.
No, she's already pregnant, and she thinks she had an event, maybe a sexual contact or an event that she may think she has been exposed to the virus.
I see.
But she's still not infected, as
okay.
far as she knows. So there's something called post-exposure prophylaxis, which can be given within a couple of days, the clinicians can correct me, to prevent infection. And then the third scenario is this person is already infected with HIV. And in that case, I will recommend to go into care as soon as possible to get the right treatments and to prevent infection of the baby, which in our healthcare setting in this country can be done.
Fantastic, thank you. We know we have an HIV clinic here with fantastic doctors there also doing clinical studies and research. So it's something to approach us and we'll be happy to guide in that area. How are we doing time? Are you okay, guys? We have still another 5 minutes.
One quick question and then a wrap up message. I think we answered most of the first part of this, but what about things like is exercise good or bad while pregnant?
Go ahead, please.
No, I was just going to answer part of it. So I think it's not the question you're asking. I'll let docs answer the exercise question, but I work with a lot of moms that have a miscarriage, stillbirth, or whose babies die shortly after birth, and they always blame themselves, like almost to a mom, they blame themselves. And they always think, you know, if I hadn't done that dance move, or if I hadn't had a fight with my boyfriend, or if I hadn't, and there's nothing you can do to 100% ensure that you won't have complications. And in most cases of miscarriage and stillbirth, there's nothing you could have done or not done. So I don't mean to scare you, and the doctors will tell you what you can do, but I just want to say out there for moms who've had miscarriages and stillbirths, like most of the time, it wasn't anything you could have done or not done, even though the temptation is to always think it is.
Fantastic. That is so true. And again, I think we are planning in the future, we're going to have talking to the expert just about miscarriages, because it's a very serious problem. And as you say, the woman feels that she is the guilty one. And in the majority of cases, maybe it was the husband the guilty one.
Well, no. A lot of times there's nothing you could have done. I'll take that. But docs and exercise. I assume the answer is yes, exercise.
Exercise generally is good. But like, you know, you've heard today, everything must be done in moderation, right? And so you don't get pregnant and then you're running a 10K. No, that's not what we recommend. But at least do it in moderation. 15 to 30 minutes exercise a day is fine for you. However, I must add that there are contraindications to exercising in pregnancy. For example, if you have a bad heart, that's not a time to exercise. So overall, it's good, but we must do it in moderation.
Fantastic. Anything else that you would like to add to that? So,
yeah, Gil?
Yes.
Gil. Some other, I mean, simple things like getting to your ideal body weight before you get pregnant. Critically important, if someone's planning to get pregnant, they should work on their overall general health. So make sure they don't have diabetes. Make sure they don't have hypertension. Getting onto a good nutritious diet. Again, getting to an ideal body weight. Well, obesity is a major problem here in the United States, and it's one of the major risk factors related to pregnancy. What about something even so much simpler? You know, the current recommendations, Gil, are for every reproductive age woman to take 400 micrograms of folic acid every day. And how often is that actually, that recommendation adhered to? Did you know that that reduces the risk of neural tube defect by 70%? Just that simple 400 micrograms a day of folic acid. And those are things that are easily done over the counter, don't need a prescription. So there are many, many things people can do to improve their overall health and their health when they're pregnant. And the last piece here, and this is, I think, maybe one of the most important issues, and that is that 50% or so of all the pregnancies in the United States are unintended, are unplanned. And we need to do a much, much better job with understanding why that happens and how to deal with it in a appropriate, respectful way, because again, if it's an unintended pregnancy, you don't get a chance to prepare for it. And if it's unintended, it could have other consequences both, you know, medical and social consequences and psychological consequences as well. So we have to think about this issue of 50% of pregnancies in the United States are unplanned, unintended. That's remarkable.
Yeah.
That's a good summary.
That's very good.
Good ending.
Yes.
Would you like to add something else?
No.
Nobody else?
That was a perfect ending.
Let's just, again, wrap it up with the idea, this concept that pregnancy is the most natural and more important period in maintaining the species. So we don't have to invent anything, because the woman or the female is stronger than ever during that period of the pregnancy in all the aspects, immunological, endocrinological, metabolical, and so on. Yeah. And it's ready to fight the environment, and it's fighting with the environment. That's what is called the resilience of pregnancy and the education of the newborn. I want to thank all of you. It was a fantastic session. We had incredible questions. Just to remind everybody, this session will be recorded and will be posted on our website, the website of the Mott Center, as a podcast. So if you miss part of it, or you would like to share it with your family, friends, and colleagues, you can download it or you can listen in our podcast at the CS Mott Center. And with this, I thank you again, and we complete today. Thank you. Bye.
Well done.